Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. When the derecho swept across Iowa on August 10th, humans were not the only creatures caught in the path of the storm. With sustained winds of over 100 miles per hour, all kinds of wild animals were impacted. This hour, how wildlife copes with and recovers from natural disasters, including floods, high winds, and fire. And wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome back to the show. We haven't done a show together since we were homeschooling in the spring, so it's wonderful to have you back.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back.
And in the wake of the terrible storm on August 10th, I have seen a lot of people asking questions about wildlife. People talking about how the morning after they didn't hear any birds singing and wondering what happened to birds, what happened to squirrels, what happened to raccoons and all of the creatures that make their homes in these trees that came down. I mean, these are all really important questions.
Yeah, they are. It was certainly a disaster of almost complete proportions in so many ways for lots of species of wildlife. They're subject to the same rules of life that that we are, and when their homes come crashing down, they certainly, some do get killed, even though we may or may not find the body. Afterwards, many wildlife, I'm sure, died in this derecho, this straight line winds that blew across the state. But some certainly got out of the way. It's quite amazing how they find shelter. There's a lot of evidence. In fact, anecdotally, if you talk to just about anyone who feeds birds, feeders seem to get emptied the day before a storm is coming in. Birds seem to be able to detect pressure differences. They don't have a TV weather person telling them, but they do seem to have internal senses that allow them to detect low pressure systems coming in, storms coming on, and they will feed very heavily in the wintertime prior to that storm. Now, I didn't necessarily notice that, at least consciously didn't notice that, that morning before that derecho hit. But certainly the many birds sought shelter. They could detect that system coming in, and they would seek shelter in various places. For example, they might seek shelter in a brush pile that you provided, or even in the lee side of a tree. Now, with those trees coming down, that's pretty tough for them. They can hang on through lots of winds, but 100 plus mile an hour winds are pretty severe damage. Severe damage to lots of species as well. Now, fortunately, this was August 10th, and many birds have already started on the migration. I know, for example, house wrens that are common all over the state and in both urban and rural environments. House wrens are already migrating south. Many warblers have already migrated south. So some things had already left, which is fortunate in a lot of ways. Most birds, in fact, were done nesting. The one exception might be a few late nesters of goldfinches and some very late nesters. But for the most part, nesting season was done. So there's no doubt that it did damage to wildlife populations. There were probably many individuals that were killed by the either falling trees or the homes that they had inside the trees as the tree toppled over. Certainly some escaped unscathed.
Well, of course, We know that as humans, if we are without shelter in the path of a windstorm like a tornado, what we're supposed to do is lay flat on the ground. And actually, I heard from a number of people who that's what they had to do during this derecho. They were out running or on a bicycle, and they just laid and let it go over them and thankfully didn't get hit by falling trees. Animals have instincts for doing things like that, right?
Right. Yeah, and but the problem with this particular storm, it was so severe that sheltering inside a hollow tree, for example,
seems like the right thing to do, right?
Right. Yeah. And doesn't make it. Now, I haven't heard. Perhaps your mom, who is a wildlife rehabilitator, maybe she has some sense. But I haven't heard from folks in my contact list anyway that they have seen an uptick of injured animals being brought in.
Well, there has been, actually. They were inundated with baby squirrels in the wake of the storm. So every wildlife rehabilitator I know in Iowa who cares for squirrels has squirrels right now.
Squirrels galore, right. And that would make sense because certainly as they were tossed out of, if their tree came down, and squirrels are one of these, they'll have several litters during a given summer, and so they would be late in the summer, still have some young ones in the trees. So, yeah, that would make some sense, but I hadn't heard that here. How about raccoons? Are they seeing increases in raccoons at all? I haven't heard
Not that I have heard of. And, of course, most young raccoons are to the point by this time of year where they're fairly independent. One of the more disturbing and maybe disgusting parts of a storm recovery like this, and I've noticed this in my own yard, even though we were really on the southern edge of the storm, and we have a couple of acres and a lot of trees. So I've noticed that I smell death more than I was before.
Yeah.
There are dead animals somewhere, and I don't know where. Is that something that a lot of people, and maybe you, I know you live in a wooded area and lost a lot of trees. Is that something that you've noticed?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. I think animals get killed. They may be under a brush pile. They may have been crushed by a tree. They may have drowned in the storm, you know, whatever, and you do smell something dead that is rotting, and that usually lasts for a day or two, and then it's all gone. The animal has deteriorated to the point where you don't smell them anymore. But that's exactly that may be all we see. You know, after a big tornado went through a part of Iowa. I was helping a friend in his cleanup on his property, and they had a line of white cedars, these columnar white cedars, basically that are very, very flexible and very strong. And birds had been nesting. Of course, that storm was earlier in the season than happened to be a tornado. And the trees had bent, but most of them had come back up. But on the ground, in the direction of the wind that hit those trees, I found dead baby birds. But, you know, the amazing thing was already, and this was the day after the storm, the adult birds were rebuilding nests in those trees. It was just phenomenal to me that sort of, just like the humans that were all around rebuilding and cleaning up and everything, those birds were doing the same thing. They were rebuilding the nests and trying to get ready to continue with life. And just as humans do that, lots of other species do as well.
Well,
but you're right. Some do get killed.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about birds because birds, again, they know how to take shelter in a storm, but this storm really was unusual. So the people who are saying, hey, I didn't hear any bird song the next morning, do you think that large numbers of birds died in this storm?
Well, I imagine large numbers. Across 150 miles front of the storm, yeah, I would say large numbers died, but we seldom, if ever, would find them. They would have been blown apart or hitting something, died, being buried underneath the debris. We'll never really know for sure. But I'm sure that over that 150-mile front, we would consider, you know, hundreds and hundreds, perhaps thousands of birds were killed in that storm. Fortunately, bird populations are usually pretty resilient. It's when they get hammered by, you know, one thing after another that you see declines over time. But this may be a temporary decline of some birds. As I said, many had gone south already. It's amazing. Some birds seem to be able to detect. There's evidence that some birds detect storms far enough ahead of time and get out of the way. So that's certainly possible as well. As some went south or north or, you know, I don't know that they could have gone above this storm, but it's fairly high. Cloud and wind, but I certainly could get out of the way. So that's certainly possible as well. But I think probably a lot of birds died in the storm. And small mammals, squirrels and that sort of thing as well, because it was so devastating. And so it wasn't like a single thunderstorm, you know, 150 miles wide. Some perhaps got out of the way, and I'm sure many did not.
Right. Well, and of course, with so many trees down, the sound of the neighborhood is going to be different anyway, because the trees that normally spend time singing next to your house may not have that place to perch anymore. We're going to pick up this conversation in just a moment. We'll take a short break. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, and we're talking about how wild animals cope with and recover from natural disasters. Of course, we've been talking about the derecho of August 10th, but we'll also talk about floods, fire, and other kinds of natural disasters. If you have observations following this derecho or questions, you are welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about how wild animals cope with and recover from natural disasters. And of course, we're talking about the derecho of August 10th, but we're also talking about other natural disasters as well, floods, fire, tornadoes. You are welcome to join the conversation with your observations or with your questions. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, just before the break, we were talking about birds and how a lot of people felt like the morning after the storm was silent in their neighborhood. We know that so many trees were lost because of this storm. And how big an impact do you feel that has? Here in Iowa, we know that the habitat for wild animals is always under pressure, but this is a lot of loss.
Yeah, it is, particularly in some areas like Cedar Rapids, where the estimates that I've seen most recently were that they lost 65% of their tree cover, and that's a huge change in habitat available for whenever you have in an area the size of Cedar Rapids, but it wasn't just there. It was across that front, 150 miles wide. You have pretty dramatic change in that landscape, and that's a rapid change in habitat. Now, fortunately, wildlife is pretty resilient. Nature is resilient. New trees will replace them. In wild areas, and that habitat will change. Now, will the bird community or the other members of the wildlife community change? Perhaps, but we won't be able to probably detect it unless there was a certain species of trees that serves one given bird species or whatever that was completely eliminated, then you would notice the change. But I don't think we will probably be sensitive enough to notice the change in species. Although in the case of Cedar Rapids, when you have 65% of the tree cover, that's a pretty dramatic change. Yeah. And you may notice some, particularly species that like mature forest environments, those species are going to find it tough to be there for the next couple of years, several years anyway. So
we have a number of people who want to join this conversation. Lori on Facebook mentions that during the storm, I watched one of the black squirrels in my backyard flatten itself upside down about 5 feet up on the trunk of a tree near my house on the side away from the wind. So there's that behavior you were talking about, taking cover out of the wind, and hopefully that tree came through it okay. Peter is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I actually have been through two of these derechos in a little more than a year. There was a catastrophic derecho in northeast Wisconsin in July of last year, which destroyed about 450 square miles of forest in northeast Wisconsin, including a forest that I helped my dad to plant 60 years ago. Oh. And all these red pines came down around me while I was inside a family cabin. In an hour, thousands of trees were all just laid down all around me. We did get those pines salvaged, and I will say on an optimistic note that things like whippoorwills are now once again evident on the landscape. More than out now, I see that there's a lot of wildflowers, and in what was a 10-acre red pine plantation, now it's wildflowers and ferns and blackberries and seedlings of oaks and maples.
Oh, Jim, I'm sorry, we couldn't hear you. What was your question?
I'd say it was more diverse landscape than it was before.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the liabilities of monoculture pine plantations is a separate topic. But we're still trying to get our loggers back to finish salvaging hardwoods in surrounding mixed forest, which is impassable now. I literally cannot walk through the woods. Crawl through, but it's not safe. And I'm concerned about larger wildlife like deer, bear, other large vertebrates, etc. If I can't safely move through the forest or even physically move through this mess with lots of downed oaks and maples, etc., I mean that even if we end up with an open parkland kind of area where trees that didn't weren't impacted are left behind, I'm assuming that for wildlife, for larger vertebrates, that clearing out this mess is probably the best thing for the future, so that a new forest can grow in the best way. I'm just curious. You know, I'd like to do the right thing by this forest, and we expect our loggers back. But I'm just interested to know what you think about what the impact is on wildlife of a forest where there's still thousands of trees down that need to be salvaged and. And that's my question.
So you're wondering if clearing those dead trees out of the forest is better for wildlife or worse for wildlife? Is that what? So Jim?
Yeah, and basically, and for the forest in the future too, not just the wild species, wild animals, but also to have a nice mixed northern forest down the road. Wouldn't it work better if we cut out these large oaks and maples that are just in you know a mess everywhere? Like I say, you can't even move through the area now.
Well, that's a great question, and it certainly changes the species that can be there. You're right, it's difficult for larger species, particularly things like deer, to move through the jumble of downed trees. There's no question that changes. But lots of small mammals, lots of amphibians, lots of fish, those those sorts of things probably are unaffected by it. So it depends on what species of wildlife you're thinking about. If you're thinking specifically about deer, then certainly removing that jumble would be good for them, and perhaps bear, black bears as well. But other species do fine with that. In fact, it provides shelter for many small mammals, so they may tend to propagate very well underneath that jumble of hardwood. The more difficult thing is, though, that when you have that sort of litter on the landscape, is that it provides fuel for a future disaster, like fire, for example, that comes through. And when you have so much available burnable fuel, it does provide sets the stage for a potential bad disaster with fire in the future. So, I guess my recommendation were me, I would say, let's get out as much as you can, keeping in mind that it doesn't necessarily make it better for wildlife. It makes it different for wildlife. And in terms of humans, our landscape, we like it less jumbled. Many other species of wildlife do just fine with the jumble of branches there. I mentioned fish because, for example, there's a lot of research now that shows that if we leave some wood in streams, that wood it provides wonderful, valuable in-stream habitat for all sorts of things, from invertebrates up through salamanders and frogs and fish, and so it's a mixed bag. It will be different, but certainly I would worry about in that area in particular. If you don't remove some of that, you're providing lots of fuel for a raging fire that could come through and burn down past minerals through mineral soil, and really provide a sort of a sterile landscape. So I'd probably remove at least some of it anyway.
Well, and maybe there is a happy medium. And when there's something that's so incredibly difficult to do that you just don't want to tackle it, you think, oh, this will be really great habitat right there. Is that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, right. For example, on our landscape, I'm using a lot of the trees that have come down from the derecho on my land, making my trails virtually impassable. And as you say, you can crawl through, but it's dangerous to do that. Things are still coming down. So I'm making lots of brush piles. So I'm making a more organized jumble, if you will, with the branches and that of various brush piles all over my woodland. And I would call it an organized jumble rather than a random jumble as well. So, it's going to be better habitat in the long run.
All right, Peter, thank you so much for your call. You are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Arthur is on the line in Wisconsin. Hi, Arthur.
Well, good morning. I'm calling from Platteville. We got the end of the derecho over here. It was pretty intense. And of course, I got to add to my brush pile, but one of the strange things that happened was that after a while, I noticed an odd bird on my feeder. It appears to be a lesser goldfinch, and they aren't supposed to be around here. So I'm wondering how many bird species maybe have been blown eastward by the derecho, and people are going to make unusual bird sightings as a result.
Oh, that's a great question, Arthur. Jim?
Great question, yeah. I have not, I watched the Iowa birding page, and I haven't seen a lot. There have been some things, there are some hummingbirds and a few other things that aren't supposed to be here, at least are not usually here. But I haven't seen since the storm, although I got to say, I've been pretty busy, so I haven't spent a lot of time on the computer looking that up. I haven't seen a lot of postings from people saying, oh, geez, we have all these new things from the West. I would say they're no more than usual, at least. So lesser goldfinch would certainly be in Platteville would be very unusual. And you didn't see it before the storm, is that correct?
Because I looked out at my feeder, which is right outside the kitchen window, and I was going, what the heck is that, you know? And it looks like a goldfinch, but it doesn't. So I went on Cornell, you know, and eBird and looked around, right. And as best I can tell, that's what it is, but I've never seen one before.
Yeah, if he's still around, I would sure try and get some photos and submit it. That would certainly be an unusual sighting for that area. It may also be, you know, a goldfinch, and this is a molting time for all kinds of birds. I have cardinals right outside my window now that have no crests because they're going through molt, and male cardinals that look sort of mottled because a lot of their red feathers are gone. So it is the time of year for a lot of birds to begin molting. And so you may have some of that, but I would, you know, submit a photo to eBird or to your local ornithological folks and see what they think. That's an interesting sighting, but I haven't answered your question. I haven't seen a lot of that occurring, but certainly that happens. Birds are always, though, trying to sort of expand their range. And from a biological standpoint, it makes a lot of sense. You know, you've always got these birds sort of on the edges of what is normal habitat, and they're the ones that, given a large-scale disaster or change in climate, they're the ones that are able to adapt to new conditions along the way. So from a species standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to have unusual birds or unusual species farther out from where they're supposed to be, as far as we know, and they may be the forefathers, as it were, foremothers that form new populations after a disaster. So it's hard to tell.
One of the things that I think it's important to talk about before we dive into the floods and fire part of this conversation is let's talk a little bit about population dynamics with wild animals, because a boom and bust cycle, a change in population, that's something that wild animal populations go through frequently.
Well, it depends on where you are. Certainly there are regular cycles of wild species that are very, very well known. They tend to be these regular cycles, the 10-year cycle of snowshoe hares and lynx, for example, across the boreal forest, not just in North America, but around the world, circumpolar. It happens in Europe and in Asia, the varying hare in Russia and across Asia, those northern boreal forests. This is a cycle that has been repeated for hundreds, probably thousands and thousands of years. And those are, as you go away from the equator, where you have very complex food webs with lots and lots of species, you go towards the poles, where you have fewer species and the food webs are a little simpler, whereas far at the pole, you get the lemmings and vole populations that hit peaks every two or three or four years. Whereas the varying hare, the snowshoe hare, hits peaks in population approximately every 10 years. So you get, as you get away from these complex food webs, you get simpler food webs, you tend to get more regular fluctuations in populations because there are fewer species to depend on. You have fewer props, as you do in the tropical and temperate zone. You move up into the boreal forest, it's a much simpler system, and so you tend to have greater fluctuations. Now, those are the fluctuations of populations that we know a lot about. There are certainly within a local area, be it Iowa or Wisconsin or the Midwest, There are certainly fluctuations of populations that may not be regular, but because of natural disasters or diseases or weather patterns, we tend to have peaks and lows in various populations. The ones we notice are, of course, the species that we use. For example, when deer populations decline because of blue tongue disease or because of CWD, chronic wasting disease, we notice because deer are hunted. Or pheasant populations, when you have a series of springs that are cool, wet springs, pheasant populations are declined for several years in a row. So we see these fluctuations, but not as much as farther north.
We are going to take another short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about how wild animals cope with and recover from natural disasters with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. You are welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Jim Pease is with me, wildlife biologist, and we're talking about how wild animals cope with and recover from natural disasters. We have focused thus far on the derecho of August 10th, and of course, that is the storm that is still so fresh in everyone's minds. But Jim, our wild creatures go through natural disasters all the time. And I want to talk a little bit about floods, because of course, Iowa is prone to really catastrophic flooding. When flooding occurs, what kinds of species are most affected by that?
Well, in Iowa, the river valleys are the primary habitat we have. We have 86% or so of the state that is used primarily for agriculture. So the river valleys and the buffers, the forests, the prairies, the savannas along those river valleys are really, really our critical habitat for an awful lot of species. In fact, you can make the argument that they are the most critical. I would make the argument, I guess, that they are the most critical habitat we have along our rivers. Fortunately, we're rich in rivers. We're not rich in wildlife habitat, except along those rivers. So they're really, really critical. In northeastern Iowa, we have, and southeastern Iowa, we have some large forests. A few places we have along the Lusk Hills, we have, some continuous prairie, but really very little of the original habitat that was here in the 1830s is present today, except along those rivers. So those rivers and creeks are really the critical habitat we have. So when that floods, depending on the severity of the flood, certainly 1993 comes to mind when we had massive floods over many, many watersheds. And that causes a significant disruption of habitat for a long, long time. Even if the flood itself may only last for a week or 2 weeks, the changes that brings in the habitat are very significant. So it's not just for riverine wildlife, wildlife that live in a river, but all the species that live in that habitat along the river. So for places like Iowa, where the habitat along the river is really critical, that's a significant disruption in their life. Depending on when the flood comes, and usually in the spring or early summer, right during the nesting season, they may or may not have time to rebuild a family. If they survive, they may not have anywhere to run to. There's not adjacent habitat upland out of that river valley. So it can be quite significant for many wildlife species.
Well, and you mentioned the disruption of nests. So in a flooding situation, depending on the time of year it hits, the greatest loss could be in the future population, right?
Yeah, exactly. Certainly to the young of that year. I mentioned earlier that for cool, wet springs are really death on a lot of ground nesting birds. We notice it in pheasant and quail populations because those are our hunted populations, so we keep better track of it. But it happens with all ground nesting birds, from meadowlarks to bobolinks and, you know, whatever. A lot of ground nesting species, when you have cool, wet springs or persistent floods or persistent rain, those young don't survive. Basically, they succumb to exposure. Cold and wet causes death in lots of young birds. The way populations, of course, cope with that is there may be temporary in certain locations, be it a single river valley or a single area of the state or a whole state, that population is down in that area for that year. But fortunately, weather patterns vary and the species is doing well in another location that is within their range. Unless you're dealing with species that are extremely rare and the habitat is extremely limited, when you're dealing with threatened and endangered species, a single disaster can have a big effect on that species. I recall when hurricane, I've forgotten now which one it was, hit Florida and some of the established populations of whooping cranes were wiped out by the hurricane. That was a significant loss for that species because they were still in recovery and they had to reestablish that population again, so it's growing again. But unless you're a threatened or endangered species, a single year's loss is generally, you may notice it in a given area, but over time it tends to recover. That resiliency of the species is ensured by having a broader range.
Let's talk a little bit about mammals in floods. I mean, we've mostly talked about nesting and birds, but of course mammals make great use of that river valley habitat as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And if they can't get out of the way, small mammals, if they don't swim very well, they can certainly drown. And particularly young ones in a burrow nest stand no chance at all. An awful lot of species are able to climb up high enough or get up out of the river valley far enough that they can survive. But it is can be, as I say, in a given disaster in a given area, it can be pretty disastrous for that particular individual. But if you think on the population level, over time, the population is able to recover. Now, again, let me emphasize, I'm really talking about those species, the generalists, the ones that are most like us, you know, that are able to adapt to a broader range of habitat. But when you have species of special concern or threatened or endangered species, those species potentially can be very, very difficult on them because there are so few individuals on a population level. There aren't that many around. So if you lose a few, it does make a difference. Well, or you lose that specific habitat type that they really need.
We were talking earlier about how wildlife rehabilitators see the results of some of these natural disasters. And one of the big things with floods is that often young will get separated. Speaking of mammals, will get separated from their parents. So wildlife rehabilitators see a lot more baby raccoons. And back when they were allowed to rehabilitate white-tailed deer, there would be many, many fawns that would come in after an event like that. Let's talk about reptiles and amphibians, though, because more water seems better, but I'll bet it's not.
No, it depends again on the species. You're dealing with some terrestrial species like ornate box turtles or three-toed box turtles that are found in some areas of the state. They tend to inhabit habitat that is drier, so it's out of the river valley. For example, box turtles, and they tend to burrow in the ground. So a single rainstorm, they will retreat to underground burrows. In a flood, they're generally out of the river valley, so they don't get impacted. Interesting thing in with storms of even fire, when you have burrowing animals, a burrow is a critical habitat for all kinds of species. You may have a fox that digs a den or a badger that digs a den, but it may be occupied by tortoises and by snakes and by insects. So all sorts of things will pour into that temporary refuge and occupy that burrow at the same time. Happens certainly with fires. Prairie fires will often find, you say, gee, how did the snakes survive? Well, they got underground pretty quickly. Some don't. Some do decline in those kinds of situations. But they're able to get into those burrows. Those burrowing animals are important little guys for providing habitat, not just for themselves, but for other species as well.
Well, and let's talk about fire before we run out of time. Of course, we see fires raging out west right now in many states, actually, at the moment. Wildfires are not something we see as often in Iowa, but fire is a prairie management tool in Iowa. So it's something that happens a lot here. When you light a prairie on fire, what does that do to the species in the prairie?
Well, certainly it temporarily changes the habitat dramatically. The overhead cover is gone. For many species, insect species, for example, it's why, you know, prairie used to cover 85% of the state. Now it's less than 0.1%, 0.1% of the original tallgrass prairie that was here remains. So when we, even in reconstructed prairie habitat, when we burn, we try to have people burn just a portion of it, maybe a quarter or a third of it each year, so that you have refugia, places of refuge, where insect species can go, and other species as well. When you get a wildfire that rages through, like it has in California, those are not good for anything, because you're talking millions of acres burned. There are very few refugia. Within the fire zone, you may have a refuge in a certain valley or in some rocks, you know, whatever. So some species do survive, but it does devastating. I was in Australia some years ago when there was a fire with my family. We got out before the fire because our guide knew that it was fire weather, 114 degrees Fahrenheit at the time. And so we got out on the only road in or out. And later that day, we saw a lightning strike, and the fire literally rolled across the treetops of these gum trees and the eucalyptus at about 60 miles an hour in the area that we had just been through. And going back in there afterwards, you found dead kangaroos, you know, wallabies. There's no question, when a fire moves that quickly, getting out of its way is very, very difficult. And so lots of things get burned up. We saw those horrible videos that came out of the fires last year in Australia when koalas were being, cared for, tried to get them out of the way. It was just it's pretty devastating. So while you have some refugia underground or in the lee of, you know, some valley or something, you have a chance. But fires that are really widespread, like in California, can be very devastating to the populations of wildlife that are in those forests.
Absolutely. And of course, when you're using fire as a management tool, you can also time it so that it can be the least disruptive possible. You don't want to do that when there are, of course, lots of little birds that are living in ground nests and things like that. I want to get a phone call in here. Ames, Lou is on the line in Ames. Hi, Lou.
Hello. Hello. Hi. I wanted to follow up on the call from Peter in Wisconsin with the and Jim's response in terms of do you let nature take its course, or do you become a gardener and do your own nurturing?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a book by Michael Pollan published in 1991 called Second Nature. And chapter 10 in that book, which I just coincidentally reread again a month or so ago, talks about this same idea of, do you let nature take its course and let everything just be there and rot, or do you want it to be a garden and right. have the imprint of man on it? And so I hope Peter is still listening, and I highly recommend he read that chapter. And for anybody here in Iowa.
Yeah, and we're running out of time, Lou, so just quickly give us the upshot.
Well, he talks about a place in Connecticut called the Cathedral Pines, and it was 42 acres of old-growth eastern white pine, and a tornado came in and leveled it. And the community had to grapple with the idea of, do we restore it as it was, or do we let it be natural? And it's a great discussion of how to restore it would not be restoring it back to nature, because it already was not nature, because it had been tended as a park in order to keep it natural as old growth. And by keeping it natural, it was no longer natural.
Well, those are some interesting things to explore. Lou, we have 1 minute left on the show, so I'm going to toss it back to Jim. And, you know, obviously there are a lot of different schools of thought there and a lot of things to think about. I know, Jim, you weren't recommending to Peter that he manicure his forest and make it into a park.
I think the difficult thing for us as humans is we're dealing with it in our human time scale. And certainly over time, and I think that's what Pollan tends to write about, over time, things will return to whatever state that they can, given that climate in that area. The difficult thing for us, and I've been into one of my favorite areas in the Boundary Waters that used to have these tall pines and very mature forests. And going back, it had been devastated by fire. And my wife and I went back just a couple of summers ago to this one of my favorite areas, and it totally changed because of the fire. Now, I get it. I'm a biologist. You know, I understand it's going to recover, but not in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so I'm viewing it from my own. So from a biological scientific standpoint, I understand it. From an emotional standpoint, dealing with that change is rather difficult. Other wildlife species have to deal with the changes that impact their immediate survival. And these big devastating storms or fires or floods make changes in the habitat that hopefully they'll be resilient and come back, but it takes time.
Right. And humans can help with that by investing in habitat as well.
Exactly.
Jim Pease, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We've been talking about wild animals and how they cope with and recover from natural disasters. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.